From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Satirist Al Franken has a new book that spoofs advice books. He's a former writer and cast member of Saturday Night Live and is well known for his political humor. On today's Fresh Air, he shares some bad advice and talks about his USO tour entertaining American troops after September 11th. Also, actor Michael J. Fox reflects on his life after the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. His new memoir, Lucky Man, is at the top of the bestseller list. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're looking for some bad advice, look no further than satirist Al Franken's new book, Oh, the Things I Know, A Guide to Success, or Failing That, Happiness. It's a spoof of cradle-to-grave advice books. Franken was one of the original members of the Saturday Night Live writing team and worked as a writer and cast member on and off until 1985. His book, I'm Good Enough, I'm Smart Enough, and Doggone It, People Like Me, was written in the voice of his Saturday Night Live character, Stuart Smalley, and spoofed the recovery movement. His bestseller, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations, satirized conservative pundits and politicians. In the book, Why Not Me?, Franken satirized presidential campaigns. He's done political humor for the Comedy Channel and Politically Incorrect, and has performed at White House correspondence dinners. He's also a popular after-dinner speaker. Have you been traveling around a lot giving speeches since September 11th? I mean, have you been on the road much?
I have. I do especially a lot of corporate speaking, believe it or not. I'm a fairly well-known Democrat. I've been on your show when I did the book, Rush Limbaugh's Big Fat Idiot. But I speak to a lot of corporations, which are usually two-thirds, three-quarter Republican. But what I've discovered is that the Democrats can't afford me. So I speak to these, and I tell them that, and then they laugh, and they feel good about themselves because they feel rich. And then I make fun of them, and they laugh, and they pay me. So I've been speaking since 9/11, and the first 6 weeks was, first of all, a lot of people canceled conferences. People were afraid to travel, and they just didn't feel it was a good idea. And then I started doing them where people from the organizers would say, Can you do your what you'd normally talk about and politics and stuff, but can you not mention 9/11? And I go like, you better just get like a really funny juggler or something because I can't not talk about it. And they went, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. And you can talk, the first thing I was able to talk about was Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. Jerry Falwell on September 13th. Was on the 700 Club and blamed 9/11 on various Americans, including gays and lesbians and people who want to secularize, the country. And Pat Robertson said, "I concur." And I remember Falwell said that he had been quoted out of context, and I found the quote. And the only way he could have been quoted out of context as if it had been preceded with, "I'd have to be a nut to say." And so he gave comedians, or at least me, something to talk about. And, I found that people, just Americans, want to laugh and they want to, the first thing I did was I went on a USO tour.
Did you really?
October.
I mean, did you really go on a USO? Because there's a parody of that in your book.
No, that's true. I know it's hard to separate what's true, but I did go on a USO tour. Yeah, I've done three of them, And this is my third year in a row. And in October, immediately after we started our action in Afghanistan, I went to Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany, and I went to Italy and Kosovo and Bosnia.
To me, USO tours are still like Bob Hope with a lot of, you know, very attractive women.
Thank you.
Right?
Oh, women. Oh, yes. Yes. Well,
so,
there's women in the military
now. What's
the
USO tour like now?
It's sort of that idea, but very scaled down. It isn't. In every time I've gone, there have been. I've gone twice with Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders and once with New England Patriot cheerleaders. This last one was with New England Patriot cheerleaders. So there's a little cheesecake for the guys, and then usually there's music, and a lot of, they like country music. We had Clint Black. This time, and I've gone with Carol King, and I've gone with Jewel, and a lot of other, so there's Ruth Pointer. It's a lot of fun. The audiences are great. They really, you know, appreciate the fact that you've come to Kosovo to to do your show, and they have a very dark sense of humor. Actually, when I was in Kosovo, I cleared this joke with the commander. I said to him, can I tell this joke? And, then I told him, he said, sure. And this was the joke. I said, you know, we were back in the United States very worried about you guys when we were fighting here in Kosovo. And Americans just did not want to take any casualties. And because of that, I know you're very circumscribed, but fortunately there were no casualties here. But you'll be happy to know since 9/11, Americans are now willing to take casualties here in Kosovo. and they just thought that was hysterical. So they, and you know, where else can you kind of tell a joke about, you know, we don't mind if you get killed. Ha ha ha, you know. So you can't tell that at a corporate event.
I want you to read an excerpt from the USO tour that you describe in your new parody of advice books, and tell me if these are jokes that you've actually told or not. Why don't you do them first, and then you could tell us.
Okay, let me find them. Okay, yeah, these are jokes I did tell. So I this is on in a chapter on the giving back to your community you ought to be doing instead of reading this. And so I talk about, you know, you do what you can do. So this was me in on the USO tour. There's a couple of the jokes I told. I got to tell you, I just say I got to tell you because that's how Bob Hope used to start his jokes. I got to tell you, everybody's caught up in this patriotic fervor, even the people I wouldn't expect. After September 11th, an old friend of mine went right to his closet, got out his old America t-shirt. Of course, it took him 4 hours to white out sucks. They like that in Bosnia. Okay. But everyone wants to do their part. My same friend told me he's going to stop buying heroin, hit the Taliban in the pocketbook. You know, these are very, you know, these are very, very sincere, sweet kids, but they have dark sensibilities.
So you've told us some of the jokes that have gone over well. Were there jokes where you said to a commander, can I get away with saying this? And he said, absolutely not over my dead body.
I had with me the New England Patriot cheerleaders, just three of them. And the one thing they told me I couldn't do was like the wing commander of the Air Force in Europe, which was I wanted to get burkas for the cheerleaders and say that the Taliban cheerleaders are with us. And they were going to, so I was going to have them come out, and they were really up for this. And so I was going to have the three women come out and talk to them in their burkas, and then have them kind of whisper to me and saying, like, you know, they're not allowed to, like, dance, and have everyone go, boo, boo, and point out to them that they're now no longer in Afghanistan. They could, and then they were going to do a routine in the burkas, like, everybody dance now, which I think would have been hilarious. So we get to Ramstein, and like I was on the plane on the way over talking to the you know, military attaché saying, we need burkas. Get me three burkas. And we get there, and, like, the wing commander has gotten whiff of this and said, and he just said, you know, we're trying to send out the message that we're not fighting Islam, that we're just, you know, we're fighting terrorism, and we think that maybe this might be a bad idea. And I kind of, you know, I couldn't, like, go, like, no! It's funny, damn it. You know, and so we ended up not doing it. And I think it would have been fine. It would have been fine. Everyone would have enjoyed it. But, you know, I didn't want to cause an international incident with a joke.
Well, but there is a kind of Taliban and the women joke that you did tell on your USO tour.
Oh, yeah. Let me find that. No, I know that joke. It's that the Taliban and our military, very, very different militaries. One thing in common, though, neither we nor the Taliban allow our women in combat. The Taliban take it one step further, however. They don't allow their women to go outside or to look up or to hum.
When you were growing up watching Bob Hope during the USO tours and when you were in college during the war in Vietnam, did you ever think that you would be on a USO tour yourself?
No, I mean, in fact, you know, you said, that it was there any joke they didn't like? And that joke I told about the American flag T-shirt, my friend who got it out, but he had to spend 4 hours whiting out, sucks. The one time they didn't like that joke, I told it first at Ramstein, which was the first place I did. I said, I got out my American flag T-shirt, and it took me 4 hours to white out, sucks. They didn't like that. Because the difference in that joke was that it was me saying that at one point I had a T-shirt that said America sucks. So, I had not imagined watching Bob Hope during the Vietnam War that I would be doing that kind of thing.
But that's interesting that you figured exactly how to fix it and still make it work.
Yes, I just blamed it on somebody else.
Exactly.
That's how you fix a lot of things in life, Terry.
I've learned my lesson. Thank you for that advice.
Yes.
That's what makes your book so good, that wonderful advice.
Yes. Well, I think that, I was thinking about talking to you about this book, and I tried to figure out how to deconstruct what I'm doing in the book. And I've thought of an example.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever done this before, and you've probably never had a humorist do this, but I want to try this. This is it's a small thing. It's about parenting, and it's in a chapter, "Oh, the violent television your children will watch," and it's in the chapter summary. Actually, let me read from it, and then I'll explain what I think I'm doing in the book. I say, and another thing, you and your spouse have to present a united front. Resolve any differences in philosophy away from your children. If, for example, one parent is prejudiced against certain minorities, you will have to decide as a couple whether to both tell racist jokes in front of them or to avoid racist jokes altogether. And remember, there are no right answers. Now, to me, and I'll never do this again, but I'm trying to deconstruct what I was doing here. I think this is what I do in the book a lot, which I tell good advice, which is parents should resolve differences away from the kids, and then present a united front, and then I'm just coupling it with a very ugly, unfortunate reality that exists. So that's kind of what I'm doing.
My guest is satirist Al Franken. His new book, Spoofing Advice Books, is called Oh, the Things I Know. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Al Franken is my guest, and his new book is called Oh, the Things I Know, A Guide to Success or Failing That, Happiness. Now, getting back to political humor, and the kind of thing you were doing on your USO tours, has it become more difficult to make jokes about President Bush since September 11th? Because you don't hear a lot of comics mocking Bushisms or, you know, mocking his intelligence, which you heard a lot of before September 11th.
Yeah, although we may be getting back to a little bit. You wanted to fall, you know, close ranks behind the president when the country's attacked.
Did you want to do that? I mean, let's remind our listeners, you did some writing for Al Gore during his presidential campaign. I mean, you're very much a Democrat. Did you feel that you wanted to get behind the president after the 11th and put a moratorium, at least a temporary one?
I wanted, certainly, on foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, President Clinton said immediately after 9/11, we have to get behind the president and do whatever he wants to do. And I agreed with that. I did. And I agreed with the policy in Afghanistan. Now, I said right immediately after 9/11 or not, but like starting 6 weeks afterwards, I started talking about, you know, the president's language is not his strong point. For example, evildoers, just not a great word. And you notice that, like, members of the administration started using evildoers, you know, like they felt like they had to make it sound like it's like a word. Like Cheney, it was very interesting to watch him. He'd say something like, this war is not about fighting Islam. It's about eradicating the evildoers. So it was that was the kind of tack I could take as a comedian was mm-hmm. about you know, some of the president's weaknesses.
Al Franken, I have it through one of my sources that you have a funny Gene Simmons story, and for our listeners who missed this, Gene Simmons of the heavy metal band
Kiss, he was on your show,
was a guest on our show, and it was quite a to do. He hurled around many insults toward me in particular and public radio in general. Entertain us with your Gene Simmons story.
Okay, here's my Gene Simmons story. It was 1982, and I was playing, at the time I was playing racquetball a lot, and I was at this racquetball club in Midtown Manhattan, and I played a weekly game with a guy. And my partner was late. So I'm hitting the ball around by myself in the court, and it has a glass wall, the back wall. And I hear this knock on the door, and it's Gene Simmons. I didn't know, actually, it was Gene Simmons till later. But he knocks on the door, and he said, I play with you? And I said, well, I'm waiting for something. Sure, why don't you come in? He said, I'll kick your ass. So I said, oh, okay, well, fine. I said, well, look, you want to warm up? He goes, no, I'll kick your ass. And then I said, well, go ahead, you serve. And he hit, now he's very big, Gene. He's like 6'2", 6'3", big, big guy.
And that's without the platform shoes.
Yes. And he serves, and he hits the ball harder than I've ever seen anyone hit the ball before. And I've played with, like, you know, really, really good players. And so the first point, you know, just goes past me, and I, you know, whiff on it. And so he's... gets the point, he says, I kick your ass. And so I said, well, okay. And then he does it again. I missed the second one, and he says, I hit 2-0. Then I figure out what he, you know, I catch up to how hard he's hitting it, and I beat him like 15-3 or 15-4. So, and by then, my partner has come, and Simmons says to me, we play again. And I said, well, no, my partner's here, and I'm going to play with him. He said, I kick your ass. And I said, well, no, my friend's here. I'm going to play with him. And he goes, bawk, 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 bawk. And he's taunting me. And I say, okay, we'll play this game for $500. And he just turns around and leaves. And my partner says, that was Gene Simmons. And that's my Gene Simmons story. He was the most awful person I'd ever met. Yeah.
See, I asked you to tell it because wherever I go, people just want to ask me about you know, Gene Simmons' appearance on Fresh Air. So I figured it's time for me to ask somebody else about Gene Simmons.
I just want, Terry, I just want you to stop beating yourself up and feeling that that whole interview is your fault.
Because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
I wouldn't go that far, but but no, I know that you felt terrible, that maybe there was something you could have done to make Gene more gentlemanly. And don't lose any more sleep over that.
Which reminds me, thanks for the advice, Al. Which reminds me, now that you've written your advice book, what's some of the worst advice you've ever been given?
Some of the worst advice I've been given, it doesn't sort of sound like terrible advice. And maybe it's the way I've internalized the advice. Always stand up for your principles is probably good advice. The way I've internalized it is burn your bridges. So I think that, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. So, in the book I say that you're going to receive bad advice, throughout your life and even from people you respect. So a big, important part of my book, in fact, in the book, I deliberately tell the reader that throughout the book, I give some bad advice to keep you on your toes. And my point is that you have to sort of take and leave advice as you get it. And however, I do remind the readers that law is not advice. That you can't take or leave.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Al Franken, so much fun to have you on the show. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry. And I could do this forever.
Al Franken's new book is called Oh, the Things I Know, A Guide to Success, or Failing That, Happiness. It's a satirical version of advice books. Here's the introduction. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is called, it's to the reader. I've never met you. I don't know much about you. But I do know you have unlimited potential. You can do anything you really set your mind to, and be anything you really want to be. What a crock, huh? Look, I'm not going to sugarcoat this. Your life is going to have a lot of ups and downs. Some of you who read this will have miserable lives and be disappointments to your parents, your children, your spouse, and to yourself, and to some extent to me. Because after all, you've read this book, or at least this part of it, and still made a mess of things. But I'm not here to add to your burden. No, I'm here to lighten it. With wisdom, with humor, and with a firm belief that no one piece of advice works for everyone.
Coming up, Michael J. Fox on life after the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. His new memoir, Lucky Man, is at the top of the bestseller list. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Michael J. Fox was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 1991, his doctor said he'd probably be able to continue acting for another 10 years. That was about right. In the spring of 2000, Fox's symptoms progressed to the point where he had to give up his leading role on the sitcom Spin City. After keeping his illness a secret for many years, he writes about it in his new memoir, Lucky Man, which is at the top of the bestseller list. Fox became a star in his early 20s with the success of the sitcom Family Ties. Some of his best-known movies are Back to the Future, Teen Wolf, and The Secret of My Success. The symptoms of Parkinson's include rigidity, shuffling, tremors, lack of balance, and diminished motor control. The intensity of Fox's symptoms varies. He's given several interviews for his new book. I asked him what he does when he gets symptomatic during an interview.
Well, actually, I've been erring on the side of caution, and I think erring is actually the right word, in that I've been medicating perhaps too much, in the sense that a lot of times the symptoms that people see in some of these interviews that have been on are actually dyskinesia, which is a reaction to the medication. Because if I were symptomatic, purely symptomatic with Parkinson's symptoms, a lot of times speaking is difficult. There's a kind of a cluttering of speech, and it's very difficult to sit still, to sit in one place. You know, the symptoms are different, so I'd rather kind of suffer the symptoms of dyskinesia, which is this kind of, you know, what I call the Axl Rose singing Paradise City, you know, this kind of weaving and and this kind of continuous thing is much preferable, actually, than pure Parkinson's symptoms. So that's what I generally do. You know, it's kind of like shooting a mosquito with an elephant gun, but that's the approach I take. So I haven't had any problems with pure Parkinson's symptoms in any of these interviews, because I'll tend to just make sure that I have enough Sinemet in my system, and in some cases too much. But to me, it's preferable. It's not representative of what I'm like in my everyday life. I get a lot of people with Parkinson's coming up to me saying, "You take too much medication." And I say, "Well, you sit across from Larry King and see if you aren't tempted."
So I know you have comparatively good and comparatively bad days. Is today a good day or a bad day?
I have good and bad days 10 times a day.
Right.
So, you know, right now this is a good moment and a fairly good day. I feel pretty good today. And this is pretty mellow and comfortable, so I'm pretty good. I'm flopping around a little bit like a fish on a boat deck, but there's nobody here to see me. I'm just in a little sound studio, so it's great.
That's the nice thing about radio. When did you first realize there was something wrong?
Well, I woke up one morning, I was down in Gainesville, Florida, and I was doing a film called Doc Hollywood, and it was a Tuesday morning, which means the night before I was probably in the bar watching Monday Night Football with all the crew. So I woke up the next day a little fuzzy-headed, to put it mildly, and I noticed that the pinky in my left hand was twitching uncontrollably, and just, you know, And it was a curiosity as much as anything else. I was fascinated by it because I couldn't stop it, no matter how I tried to restrict it, or I couldn't will it away. And I would physically hold it, but as soon as I released it, it would start up again. And I consulted with a neurologist down there who said that it was probably an injury to my ulna or my funny bone. I went down that track very quickly and thinking that it was something physiological. And it was a year later that with some other rapidly, building symptoms, rigidity on my left side and some slowness and some other things, in addition to the escalating tremor, which had by then gone into my hand and into my arm, that was when, a full year later, that a neurologist finally gave me a definitive diagnosis.
Yeah, as you mentioned in your book, Parkinson's is very rare for people under 50, and it's usually people even older than that who get it. And you say that the first literature you were given had an elderly couple on the beach at sunset, and there you were in your 20s.
Yeah, I remember the pamphlet. I can't remember what the medication was. And there was this elderly couple strolling on the beach, and there was a seagull above their head, and they both looked really happy. I say in the book that it was hard to tell which one had the incurable neurological disease, but because they both looked great and pretty pleased with things. And there was a seagull flying overhead, and he looked good too. And I wanted to hit him with a rock. And it just was very hard for me to process the whole thing. It just made very little sense to me. I found that, looking back on it, I was very, I took the news very passively and very, I just kind of sat there. I didn't have a big explosive reaction because it was literally like somebody telling you they had just discovered your parents were Martians. It just didn't compute.
You said that about three other people who you used to work with when you were in your teens and you did a Canadian TV show. This was in 1977. The three other people who worked on that show also had early onset Parkinson's disease. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I've since learned that they did. And, it's being investigated as a cluster, and it certainly sounds like a cluster, and clusters exist with other diseases and other and in other situations, and they're usually associated with something environmental or a sick building or that kind of thing. It could be viral, which is the hypothesis, or at least the theory of the investigating doctor up there, researcher up there in Canada. I don't know. I mean, it could certainly be a cluster. It could also quite possibly be coincidence. I'm concerned for my coworkers, but from a personal point of view, it's not something that I'm, devoting a lot of time or energy into in the sense that, this is the answer. I've kind of moved beyond this being a personal thing, as strange as that might sound. And so I'm interested in clusters in general, and I'm interested in things like biomarkers and genetic predisposition and issues like that, but not, wholly on a personal level, and not to the extent that I want to put aside a lot of those things to focus on this, one event.
After your diagnosis, you decided to tell only families and selected friends and associates. What were your fears of what would happen if everybody found out?
My experience with the celebrity and with a certain elements of that made me very distrustful of letting anything out that I wanted to process it myself first, or at least I wanted to ignore it myself first, and then in time process it. But I just didn't want to put it into the machinery and have it kind of processed publicly and have, the tabloids have a run at it and let other people have a run at it and come up with opinions and conclusions when I was, still kind of flailing. So I was very distrustful of letting it out there. And also, I didn't really articulate it this way early on, but I eventually did, because I was involved in comedy, I thought, if people know that I'm ill, would they be able to laugh at what I do? I say in the book, can you laugh at a sick person without feeling like an asshole? It was a concern of mine. So a lot of these things were in my mind. And who among us, walks down the street and leads with, hi, I've got a boil on my ass, We
right,
keep these
right.
things to ourselves.
With the comedy thing, especially if there's physical comedy involved, where, part of the joke is that you walk into a wall or something like
right.
that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that was a difficult thing. It was one of the nice things about having written this book is it was a really nice transition for me from going from a craft where I relied on a good deal of physicality and a good deal of mastery over, making my body do things that were, kind of bizarre and athletically demanding in some cases, to a place where I couldn't do that anymore, but instead was able to basically lock myself up for 14 months and write a book.
Right.
And it was nice to have made that transition, at least for myself.
When you were telling selected friends and family that you had Parkinson's, were you confident that people would keep the secret? Or did you have to go around worrying, what if somebody leaks it?
No, I'm lucky that I think the quality of the friends that I had and my family, and especially with them having gone through, you know, 4 or 5 years of what I call the fun house, you know, having been in the public eye, that at that point I was pretty confident in the discretion of those that I'd chosen to talk to about it, and they were all pretty great. So it was, you know, it's kind of funny. I was so good at keeping the secret from so many people that it shouldn't have been a surprise to me that I was equally good at keeping the secret from myself. And that was really, you know,
what do you mean by that? By keeping up.
Well, yourself? You know, I would constantly somehow, you know, I would not deal with it as a fact. I would deal with it as something that was negotiable, because in so much of my life I've been able to negotiate and, you know, kind of dealing with acting and dealing with things where it's about impression. And it's about if I can make it look a certain way, then that's really what it is for all intents and purposes. But when you have this constant reality, this you know, implacable fact of the disease, you know, it took me a long time to get to that. And so almost in a way, by keeping it a secret from other people, I could in effect keep it a secret from myself. And that probably goes to the core of your original question about why keep it a secret. It was like the less people knew, the less people could bring it up to me, and the less people that brought it up to me, the less I had to really deal with it.
My guest is Michael J. Fox. His new memoir is called Lucky Man. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael J. Fox. He has a new memoir called Lucky Man. It was after you were diagnosed that you got the job on Spin City. How did you decide who to tell about it? Like, did you tell Gary David Goldberg, the creator of the show, who had also created Family Ties?
Yeah, I did. I went into it. By that point, I was kind of had gone over the curve of acceptance and had done a lot of work on my own with understanding and accepting the disease. And so when I went into it, you know, I specifically picked the people that I worked with and also the forum and you know, the idea of doing a sitcom again, doing it in New York, being near my family, kind of setting the schedule and for the first time making sure that everybody that I worked with was aware of the, in the tightest inner circle, you know, my production partners and network and whatnot knew what I was dealing with and had accepted the possibility that it might be a problem down the line, certainly not in the short term. And that was a great relief to me, and it was very liberating.
So everybody was confident that you could do it?
Well, they were willing to take a bet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seemed like a good pony. It was one of those things where the pony might go lame in a while, but we think he can make it down the home stretch. So
at what point did you have symptoms that you had to disguise during shoots?
Well, I think before I ever, right from the beginning, in the sense that even something as small as a tremoring hand is something that you find yourself putting your hand in your pocket, or you can interrupt symptoms, at least with Parkinson's early on, by, you know, manipulating props and putting your hand in your pocket, leaning against a wall. Any kind of break in the circuit causes a pause in the tremor. And then as time went on and I was doing the show, when it started to get more kind of global in my body, and so that 3 or 4 body parts would be going at the same time, and it kind of got to where I had to be more than just a sleight of hand artist and almost a contortionist. You know, that's when it really started to consider, you know, moving on.
You describe Parkinson's as being about resting tremors. If you're resting, the tremor starts, but if you move, it temporarily stops the tremor. So you say, if you say, picked up a cup or picked up a pencil, it would stop the tremor. And so you did that a lot while you were shooting. Spin right. City. Do you think it ever gave you the look of being fidgety or having a certain nervous energy in the show because you were doing things like that?
Well, I think that had so long been a part of my persona that it was kind of seamless in a way. In fact, I say in the book, talking about the inverse kind of outward physical deterioration and inward emotional and personal development, that I couldn't really be still until I could no longer keep still. You know, it's this great irony that by the time that I had a kind of an inner calm, I was so outwardly frantic. And I get very used to the fact that, I tell people all the time, body language lies. Don't make any assumptions based on what you see my body doing or the way I may look, as to whether I'm nervous or agitated or excited. There's a complete separation between the two. But performing, I would incorporate it into everything I did. You can see a lot of times if you watch a lot of those old tapes, I'll be leaning against a desk or I'll be picking up a prop. And as I said, by then, it surprised me how few people noticed it. I had a thing that I showed my son very early on that he could, if he saw my hand shaking, he could grab my thumb and give it a twist, and it would, if he counted to five and did it again, he would in fact stop it from ever tremoring, because that's about the period of time that it takes. And I'll never forget teaching him that. And then at one point he did it for a while and thought it was great that he could do this every time. And then when he realized that it would start up again, he kind of looked at me like, oh my God, what have I got myself into? And I said, no, you don't have to do this all the time, just if you want to. But it was an interesting, thing, so that whatever I appeared to be doing at any given time, I was really doing something else. I was constantly doing the math and constantly figuring out, what my options were when that next tremor would come, so that how I was going to get to something that could disrupt it.
Were you in on what the final script of Spin City, the final episode that you starred in, would be like, and how your character would be written out?
Yeah, the actual device that was used was something that the writers came up with, but as we got into the nuts and bolts of doing the show, I got more involved and actually took, pen to paper, and just in terms of trying to integrate some of the things that I was feeling and anticipate some of the things that the audience might feel.
Why don't you describe what the premise of that final episode was?
Boy, my memory serves. I think my character took the fall for an apparent connection between City Hall and organized crime. And he realized he had to take the hit for the mayor. And that's something that, that he felt, Mike Flaherty felt, fell within his job description. So he did it. And he was aware that meant that he would have to leave City Hall and leave politics for a time. And so that it was, the last part of the show was really this long, kind of prolonged goodbye.
Well, what were your thoughts about how to best promote your departure from the series? The very special Spin City kind of thing.
Well, the thing is, I'd said early on too, when we were talking about what kind of show we wanted to do, and that if you ever read in TV Guide, a very special Spin City, you could, with my permission, come up and hit me in the head with a frying pan. That was never, my intention. But at a certain point, the network kind of does what they do, and they're going to promote it the way they're going to promote it. But I was getting, I'd also experienced this connection that I'd had, that I'd always kind of rationalized away previously between myself and an audience that had come to know me over the years. And earlier on in my career, it had been much more convenient, and it seemed to me to make much more sense to say, well, in a way, this is this kind of business thing that's being transacted, and I go out and do what I do, and people watch it or don't watch it and buy the product that's advertised or don't. And, it just seemed much safer to look at it that way. But once I had disclosed my diagnosis, the depth and the sincerity of the connection that I felt with people that approached me and that watched the programs and wrote to me and called and whatnot and supported our foundation and our efforts just seemed so real that I felt that in the last show I had to in some way address that and be respectful of it. And, then how the network, through their promotion, may kind of up that a notch or not really was beyond my control, but I did feel very overwhelmed and in a good way by the response and wanted to honor it. So that kind of went into it.
I want to quote something that you write in your memoir about acting. You say, actors don't become actors because they're brimming with self-confidence. For those of us lucky enough to become professional performers, the uncertainty about who we really are only increases. For many actors, this self-doubt is like a worm eating away at you and growing incongruously in direct proportion to your level of success. No matter how great the acceptance, adulation, and accumulation of wealth, gnawing at you always is the deep-seated belief that you're a fake, a phony. Is that what you were experiencing as you became like more famous, more that you were experiencing less self-confidence? And
yeah, I write that earlier in the book, and then I think later in the book I kind of expand that in a way. In the sense that for most of us, the first word probably that we learn and understand is no. And in a lot of ways, you know, no describes home to us in a way. You know, it defines boundaries. And all of a sudden you're in this place where you hear nothing but yes, and you in turn say nothing but yes. And I don't mean this by way of complaint. In fact, when I talk about celebrity, I try to step back from it and be somewhat detached. Because, you know, there's a lot about it that's fun. But it is strange, and it's strange to you know, realize that you're doing something, you're doing it as well as you can, but really what is it in the fullness of human endeavor that is so spectacular about this, and you're torn because you love the cars and you love the girls, you know, that never would give you the time of day, that are all of a sudden you know, very available to you, and all these great things are happening to a 23-year-old. And at the same time, too, you're thinking, this is strange. You know, someone's going to come and knock on the door and say, you know, this is all over. You know, go back to Canada and don't take any of this stuff with you. So there is this feeling that yeah, there's no way that you can deserve this.
My guest is Michael J. Fox. His new memoir is called Lucky Man. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Michael J. Fox is my guest. He has a new memoir called Lucky Man. You say in your book that you've gone back and you've watched old tapes and older movies that you made. Do you notice symptoms or tremors that you didn't realize were symptoms at the time?
Yeah, I can see it now. With old Family Ties episodes, that was, you know, 4 or 5 years before I was diagnosed, and they say that by the time the first symptoms are present, as much as 80% of the dopamine-producing cells in your brain are already dead or dying. So the great likelihood was that I did have cell death occurring during that time. And, you know, I can see a weakness on the left side or certain things that I was doing much, you know, obviously not consciously, but I can see an interruption in the rhythm on my left side and other things and some of that old work, so it's, you know, the brain is an amazing, amazing machine, both in the way that it works and in the way that it breaks down. You know, it's fascinating from that point of view, and I've actually gotten to a point where I can be fairly detached about it.
You say in your book that when you got sick, you eventually gave up drinking. Had drinking been verging on a real problem for you?
Well, in the 80s when I was younger, as I said, you know, we're talking about that that feeling that someone was going to come and knock on the door and take it all away. And so my kind of loosely thought out theory was that I'll be drunk when they get there. And you know, not so much that I drank, but I was working in those kind of situations, because that was fantasy enough for me that I was actually doing that for a living. But in the other time, I wanted to distract myself from the possibility that as I said, perhaps it was undeserved or perhaps it was going to end. But by the time I got married, that had really calmed down a lot. And then shortly on the heels of getting married, of course, came the diagnosis. And then drinking, well, again, not rising to the level that would be dramatically dysfunctional. I certainly recognized that I was using it, you know, more as a means of escape and more as a means of self-medication, and not looking at what my new reality was. And when that hit a point where it was obviously disrupting my family and breaking down the communication that I had with them about my health and other issues, then I just knew that it was time to stop it. And really stopping it, although not immediate, the next phase was not immediate. It certainly led to my being able to really look at my diagnosis and accept it and move on.
Do you think that dealing with the tremors of Parkinson's has made you more of a self-conscious person? And were you self-conscious before that?
Well, actually, now it's actually really terrific, because, you know, vanity goes out the window. I mean, if you're talking about self-conscious in the sense of how one appears to others and one's awareness of how they appear to others, you know, it's so apart from how I feel and perceive myself that I think about it very little now. I think about dealing with symptoms in public more on the level of how will it help me to function and accomplish the things that I want to accomish. In other words, you know, if I'm in a situation where I need to communicate, will I be able to communicate? Or if I have to perform some physical task, you know, whether it was with my children or something else, will I be able to do it? In terms of how will I appear? Well, that might have been the major concern earlier on. It's little or no concern now. I write in the book about being at a public function where I was clearly symptomatic and demonstrably tremoring and twitching and a lot of people were looking at me, and I was aware that they were looking at me. Yet it didn't concern me. And then at some point the lights went down and a concert began, and I was happy that once the lights went down, actually my medication kicked in and I smoothed out, and I was really relieved and pleased that I would be relatively symptom free to enjoy the music. And that was really represented a 180 degree turn for me, in that I wanted to be symptom-free for me to be able to enjoy what I wanted to enjoy, as opposed to wanting to be symptom-free to create an appearance that I was healthy, or at least create an illusion that I was healthy. So it changed a great deal.
Michael J. Fox, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Michael J. Fox's new memoir is called Lucky Man. He chairs the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Disease. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Franklin Flyer, a novel set during the 30s and 40s by Nicholas Christopher, author of A Trip to the Stars. This is NPR, National Public Radio.